This is A.B. Dowji, and this is The Big Picture. Yes, it's in the new time slot, Saturday between 11 and 12. Isn't it wonderful to have it on Saturday morning instead of Friday when you're rushing around, going to work, and the dal is boiling on the stove? Now you're more relaxed. But you know what? It's not the same, eh? I miss the big man. Yeah. We had such a wonderful rapport, a repartee, an innocent, good-natured chiding. Lovely words, though. Good-natured chiding. But I suppose we all have to move on. And here we are. Yes, it's The Big Picture. The program in which anything happens and usually does. Now, as usual, we start with the story that caught my eye. Something zany, outrageous, nonsensical, totally silly, unbelievable, mind-blowing, bizarre story that made it into the media. So, let's go to the first one, okay? But let me begin by stating something that's well-known and pretty obvious. Smoking is bad for you. It could lead to cancer and all kinds of other nasty ailments. These days, you don't see many people with a cigarette dangling from their mouth. It's almost like a person is a little embarrassed to be regarded as a smoker. Well, I suppose it's all got to do with the fact that there are institutions, or shall I say restrictions, all over. In public buildings, in restaurants, and so on. So there is pressure to quit. It's regarded as being antisocial. And it's also quite an expensive habit. What does cigarettes cost these days? About, I think it's more than 30 rands for a packet. So yes, cigarettes are bad for you, for your health. But did you know that cigarette lighters are also bad for you? Yeah, seriously, cigarette lighters are bad for you. Well, let me just explain that a little bit. Cigarette lighters are bad for you, especially if they land up in your stomach. So, what's all this about, I hear you say? Well, let's go to the actual story. It's and for this story, we go to the good old U.S. of A. The good old U.S. of A. So, here we have this 49-year-old Laddu. He has severe stomach pains. So, he goes to the hospital. His blood and urine are checked out and everything seems to be normal. An X-ray is done. A very fuzzy image is revealed. It looks like a cigarette lighter. The lighter is in an upside-down position, and liquid from the lighter is pouring into his stomach, is leaking into his stomach, and makes a hole in his stomach. It's a big ulcer. Well, they managed to get an endoscope into his stomach with some sort of a gadget in the front to grab the lighter. And now this jungly is on the road to recovery. But let me ask you this. Didn't this fellow know that he had swallowed a lighter? You know, it's not every day that you put such a thing into your mouth and of course, swallow it after that. If you had to swallow it, you won't forget that at all. You rush off to the hospital. Well, he didn't actually rush off to the hospital. So, while they were checking his stomach to see if anything was there, you know what, I think they should have x-rayed his head to check if there was anything inside. Another fellow who is suffering from chronic BDD, which as you all know is a medical term, Badam Dood Deprivation. His name is Darren Young. Now you remember in the old days in school when you did something wrong, you had to write 100 lines or even maybe 200 lines, if it was something really bad. I will not talk in class. I will not talk in class. I will not talk page after page. And of course the hand was got all numb and was about to fall off. So this 30-year-old young man, Darren Young, was booted out by his girlfriend. And there was a court order in February against him that he should not harass her. But in a period of 3 hours, he called and he texted her 144 times. 144 times. And he said all very horrible things to her. And so he was arrested and brought before a judge for ignoring the court order. He was brought before a judge. And what is the judge's name, incidentally? Her name is Judge Rhonda Poo. Yes, her name is Poo. I'm sure that Judge Poo is not going to take any sheer nonsense from anyone. Very tough lady indeed. So, she handed out some very unusual punishment, a sentence to Darren Young for violating the court order. And now I'm reading to you from the Telegraph newspaper. It says here, Judge Liu told him, "It's so childish to think a grown man can be so thumb happy. I don't know whether I should cut off your fingers or take away your phone to get you to stop texting. You probably shouldn't get a phone, period. I hope she changed her number. For every nasty thing you said about her, you're going to say a nice thing. No repeating words. No repeating words." So this character was also ordered to pay $2,400 in fines, which is about 30,000 rands, and sentenced to 200 hours of community service. He has 144 days to write all the compliments for his ex-girlfriend. So there you are. Well, he contacted her 144 times in 3 hours. So for 144 days, every day, he has to write wonderful things, compliments to her, and no words must be repeated. If he said the word beautiful about her, he can't use that word again. Or maybe very intelligent, or compassionate, and so on. Use the word twice in complimenting her, and is back into the throng for this Alu. Sure, I don't know which is worse, eh? Writing, it's a bit of a torture, they say, writing nice things with no repeats or throng, which is better, I don't know. And now to the next story. You know, dear listeners, the world will never be short of idiots. There is an oversupply. There is an oversupply. There's one born every day. No, a person doesn't have to be educated to be a first-class mampara. And yesterday I nearly fell off my chair when I read this headline in the British Independent newspaper. Egyptian lawyer Nabi Al-Wahas says it's a national duty to rape girls who wear revealing clothing like ripped jeans, for example. Now, this fellow is a prominent conservative lawyer. That's how he's been described. And he was taking part in a TV panel discussion. And he said, these are his words, "Are you happy when you see a girl walking down the street with half of her behind showing? I say that when a girl walks about like that, it is a patriotic duty to sexually harass her and a national duty to rape her." Dear listeners, dear listeners, I find it very difficult to comment on the stupidity of this fellow. He says it's your patriotic duty to molest women not dressed properly, and he's described as a conservative. What does that mean? That he is religious? Well, I don't know what religious principles he is applying, but I have no hesitation in declaring him the unrivaled Mampara of the week, a jungli of the first order. But as I said, there is no shortage of Mamparas in this world. You know, that silly lady is at it again. Aung San Suu Kyi. Sometimes her name is pronounced Suki. I'm not sure she is very Suki in considering in regard to the terrible suffering all around her. And this just in. On Wednesday, Reuters news agency, the photographers saw thousands of desperate Rohingya wade through shallows and narrow creeks between islands of the Naf River to reach neighboring Bangladesh, as the exodus begun 2 months ago was far from over. Some had small boats or pulled makeshift rafts to get to Bangladesh on the river's western bank, but most walked, children cradled in their arms, and the elderly carried on their backs with sacks of belongings tied to staves, to sticks on their shoulders. Reaching the far side, some women and older people had to be pulled through the mud to reach dry land atop very steep banks. But you know what? This Aung San Suu Kyi, she doesn't know that there is suffering all around her. Remember a few weeks ago, she said that she will try to find out from the Rohingyas why they are running away from Myanmar. And before that, she said that it's the military who were responding. The military was responding to attacks from Muslim terrorists. That's why you have the problem there, you see. They were just responding. And then she also said that Muslims are burning their own villages, and also that people on both sides, Buddhists and Rohingyas, are dying from the violence. There's like some sort of a balance. Well, this auntie should just shut up. Or maybe she should hug her Nobel Prize very tightly in case they take it away from her, which many people are threatening to do. Remember, I keep saying, it's better to keep silent and let people think that you are stupid instead of opening your mouth and removing all doubt. Well, this auntie decided to go out into the areas where Rohingyas live. That's what she did this week, to see for herself what's happening. Why so many people have left, and the number at the moment is 600,000 and rising every day. She wants to know firsthand about what's happening there. Ah, shame, eh? Maybe she doesn't have Al Jazeera or BBC or CNN. And so in a carefully organized walkabout, she met with hand-picked Muslims and heard their stories. It must have been quite a tame session, because these people were hand-picked. And then she made a dramatic statement. Wow, what a dramatic statement. What did she say? Did she say that she is shocked at the terrible ethnic cleansing that is carrying on? Did she have tears in her eyes while saying that the Buddhists must stop massacring women and children? Did she say that the Myanmar government must rebuild all the houses, all the villages that were burned down, and that tons and tons of emergency food supplies must be brought in to ease the plight of the starving thousands, hundreds of thousands? Did she say that the military must help to bring back the thousands who crossed into Bangladesh? Did she say all of that? No, dear listeners, no. One of the Rohingyas present at the meeting said, and this was reported in the British Telegraph newspaper. It says here, on, where is that now? It says here, okay, I seem to have missed that one, where she says that, well, there must be peace in the area. And she also said that the quarreling must stop. The quarreling must stop. Those are actual words. Good heavens! Did you hear that? The people should not quarrel among each other. There is no ethnic cleansing, no genocide, no atrocities, no suffering, just people quarreling. That's all. You see? Like two neighbors, for example, quarreling. That's what quarreling means, two neighbors quarreling. Hey, why you stole mangoes from my tree? Eh? What you barking for, eh? The branches from your tree are all hanging over my yard, and the leaves are falling and all, and I have to clean up the mess, so why I can't take some mangoes, eh? But you didn't ask my permission first. Why I must ask your permission, eh? Your tree didn't ask my permission to mess my yard. So, dear listeners, you see, it's just a quarrel. in Myanmar. Some silly misunderstanding or something. Much ado about nothing. Can I tell you what? This brainless lady makes me want to scream. That's right. Makes me want to scream. Scream very loudly at her idiotic statements. I must admit that I do shout out in frustration sometimes at the TV when some moron says something that is really, really silly or shocking. Yes, 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 I know that it won't make any difference to the person on the TV, but, yeah, well, you get, you just get it out there, you know, you just get it out. You shout, loud shout, hey, stop talking rubbish, you dirty, stinking, rotten liar. Shut up, shut up. You just shout it out. This is what I hear myself saying many times. Not good, I must admit, not good. But yes, it has a cathartic effect. Hey, nice word that, cathartic effect. It means that you feel some relief inside from something that made you stressed. For example, someone said something hurtful to you and you have a good cry and then you feel relieved. It's out of your system, off your chest. Cathartic. Well, maybe you can use that word today when the hubby comes home and he's got his mouth full of acne. You can tell him, for example, you know, your sister always picks on my cooking and I always stay quiet, but you know, today I told her straight, you can't even fry an egg without breaking the yolk, and you're talking so much. She got shocked and said nothing. First time her mouth was shut. And you know what? It was such a cathartic experience, I tell you. I feel much better and all. Well, I can tell you what will happen. The bully will choke on his acne, and for the rest of the afternoon, he will be looking at you sideways and wondering where you learned all these things. So there you are, folks, screaming out at a taxi, suddenly cutting in front of you, even though your window is closed and the driver can't hear you. Makes the irritation go away. A cathartic experience. And so, in 4 days' time, November 8th, more than 30,000 people will be in a park in Boston in the United States. What will they be doing there? They will be screaming at the top of the voices at the sky, screaming to let out their frustration. Why? And what is this all about? Well, it's a very, very important anniversary on the 8th of November. Do you know what it is? Anyone? Well, I won't tell you right now, because we shall go for a break. Welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture, and this is, of course, A.B. Dowji. And in this part of the program, we will have a guest every week, and today we are honored to have Shannon Ibrahim, who is the Independent Media's foreign editor. Now, she has a weekly column in which she analyzes international and local issues with a very critical eye. And this week, her brilliant article focuses on Afghanistan and more especially on America's presence there. Shannon Ibrahim, welcome to The Big Picture.
Thanks, AB. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Right, let's get to the issue. Is America winning in Afghanistan?
I don't think we can answer that in the affirmative, because Afghanistan has always been the graveyard of empires, and I don't think it'll be any different this time for the United States. It's just simply that successive American administrations have refused to concede defeat, believing that by maintaining a presence on the ground that they can safeguard America's broader strategic interests. But in the end, America's presence in Afghanistan will likely drain their resources and weaken their ability to maintain global dominance. And when you think about it, AB, this is actually America's longest war. And over the past 16 years, it's cost American taxpayers over $1 trillion. And I believe that this year it's going to cost $50 billion. That's about $1 billion a week when you think of it.
Yeah. Wow. And Shannon, others have also tried to tame Afghanistan in recent times and they have failed.
You're right. The Soviet Union had only managed to occupy Afghanistan for 10 years. That was from about 1979 to 1989. And then, as we know, the Soviet Union was routed by the CIA-backed Mujahideen. And that contributed actually to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But before even the Russians, it was the British that had a hard time occupying the country for any length of time. So they tried to keep their interventions short. That was even at the height of the British Empire. And before the British, it was the Mongols of Genghis Khan. They had war victories in Afghanistan, but they were actually unable to control Afghanistan for very long. And if we go even further back in history, there's Alexander the Great. And the resilience of the Afghan warriors always fought off foreign occupation. And it seems that the thing that's always unified those tribes in Afghanistan is their pride and independence. So the U.S. probably needs to learn the lessons of history in that regard.
But America faces or faced a new enemy when they entered Afghanistan.
Yes, that was the Taliban. And for those that don't know, the Taliban, actually the word means youth. And they were originally they were the students of the CIA-funded Mujahideen. And now when the Americans faced the Taliban and they tried to rout them from their own country, the Taliban continues to say, even to today, that the Americans have the clock, but we have the time. And they're very right, because after a decade and a half of war, the Taliban still controls anywhere from about 45 to 50% of the country. And the central government of Ashraf Ghani, he only controls minimal territory outside the capital, Kabul. And so despite all the training that they've given to those Afghan security forces, they're unable to defeat the Taliban. And that's probably because they use the rugged mountainous terrain to hide and attack in the form of guerrilla warfare. So I think in total, America has actually lost 2,404 soldiers in Afghanistan in these 16 years, with 20,000 suffering injuries. But that actually pales in comparison to the 111,000 Afghans, including civilian soldiers and militants, who are estimated to have been killed in the conflict. So it's no wonder, if you consider those figures, that in 2013 Donald Trump had tweeted, "We should leave Afghanistan immediately, no more wasted lives. If we have to go back in, we go hard and quick. Let's rebuild the U.S. first." But that strategy was actually tried by President Barack Obama and it failed.
So Shannon, why did America go into Afghanistan in the first place?
Well, it was President George Bush who decided to invade in 2001. That was in response to the 9/11 attacks and what he called Operation Enduring Freedom. And within 1 year, there were 10,000 U.S. soldiers deployed into Afghanistan. And then again, by 2008, there were 48,500 soldiers on the ground. And it's sad because these soldiers, they didn't know the language, the culture, the religion, the ethnic and sectarian divisions, or even the country's history. And the U.S. strategy has been to train an Afghan army that can fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and then to withdraw. But even, I believe it was in 2007, the goal of the Americans was to have a 216,000 strong Afghan army, but that was not met. The Afghan security forces didn't have any serious air force, artillery, logistics, or medical services. And the U.S. presence, even in their army, was small. So I think how we can understand that is the problem was that U.S. forces and resources were being diverted to the war in Iraq, meaning that the U.S. was operating on multiple fronts. And the U.S. really did nothing to win the hearts and minds of Afghans, and instead they installed, as we know, a puppet government in Kabul that had no legitimacy. And the money earmarked for nation building never reached the people, and perhaps most importantly, the Americans have never had a dialogue with the Taliban on the future of the country. And then, as you know, then comes Obama, and he had a whole new approach of surging U.S. troops to 100,000 by 2010, and his generals kept promising to break the stalemate. And with the additional NATO troops on the ground, the Pentagon actually thought that they could realize their objectives. But they never poured in the necessary resources, and the strategy of trying to build an Afghan security structure that could combat the Taliban was undermined. And really, by the time Obama was leaving office, they were no closer to defeating the Taliban, despite all those troops on the ground. And then we saw an about-face. The Obama White House then said that they were going to withdraw their troops by the end of 2014. Obama even said, we are no longer at war with the Taliban. And then I think what they realized is the Taliban became very resurgent as Obama was about to leave office, and they didn't want all of their bases overrun. So they basically then said that they would leave a minimum of about 10,000 troops on the ground. And what's very sad is that despite all what Donald Trump said during his election campaign, he's now saying that he's going to make U.S. military presence in Afghanistan permanent.
Well, very interesting indeed, Shannon, but as you indicated to me earlier today, you have another engagement, but I'm sure you have much more to say on this subject.
Yes, there was so much to say that I thought it was important people understood this history. So the subject of part two, which will be on the Sunday Independent and on IOL as well as the Tribune and the Argus, that is more about the flawed rationale of the U.S. remaining in Afghanistan. And why is it that Trump wants to keep all of America's bases in Afghanistan, you know, when he said we should have nothing to do with that country? And there's some very important geostrategic reasons for that, which is, I could, if you like, talk about that next week.
Yes, we will certainly tap into that information next week. And so, listeners, you have been listening to Shannon Ibrahim, and she is the Independent Media's foreign editor. Excellent analysis about America's presence in Afghanistan. Shannon Ibrahim, thank you once again for taking time to be with us.
Thanks, Amy. Have a good day.
Okay. And you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Right, there we are. So, before the interview, I was asking you a very, very important question. I said to you that 30,000 people will be in a park in Boston on the 8th of November, and also in Philadelphia and New York and Austin, Texas, and in other cities all across the United States. What will they be doing? Well, they will all be screaming at the top of their voices. They'll be screaming at the sky to let out their frustrations. Why and what is this all about? Well, it is a very important one-year anniversary. Do you know what that is? Anyone out there? I don't see any hands. Anyone? No? It's the one-year anniversary of the announcement that Donald Trump has been elected the President of the United States. That's right, folks. President Pagla, a first-class Ullu, became the most powerful man in the world. The man who has his finger on the red button that could unleash a nuclear holocaust. Can you imagine it? Out of 350 million Americans, they could only find this genius to be their leader. Well, I suppose that's what they call democracy. Freedom to elect the dumbest person in your society. Well, I don't think we should talk too much, eh? Out of our population of 49,000,000 Well, we managed to elect the most caring and upright and honest and compassionate ethical individual that this fair land has been blessed with. How fortunate we are, eh? And cry, the beloved country. Can someone start something like what's going to happen on the 8th of November? Can somebody start that here? A screaming session in each of the cities. It's so easy, actually. They are using social media in the United States. They've galvanized all the support. Well, I suppose it's quite silly, of course. But it will draw attention to the elephant in the room. Corruption. Thousands can gather at Zoo Lake or the Blue Lagoon, known here as the Lugs, and can all collectively shout very loudly, Bring back the billions from Dubai. Bring back the billions from Dubai. Or maybe they could shout, not another Zuma for president. Please, please, not another Zuma for president. Or maybe, capture the captured and put them in throng. Capture the captured and put them in throng. I like that last one. What you say? Anyone ready to start something on social media? Okay. Back to my man, President Pagla. The twit just can't get his fingers to stop tweeting. The twit just can't get his fingers to stop tweeting. He keeps sending out one stupid thing after another. He tweets. I think he should be brought in front of Judge Poo. She should take away his laptop and cell phone and order him to say only nice things. Very difficult job that for him to say only nice things. And his latest blunder is to comment on the recent attack in New York. Let me read to you from the British Independent newspaper. It says here, in the wake after the, in other words, after the New York terror attack, it has become the contrast that some claim speaks volumes about Donald Trump. When a white American with a semi-automatic rifle killed 59 people in Las Vegas, in the worst mass shooting in the United States history, it took Mr. Donald Trump 5 hours to offer his condolences and even longer to suggest it wasn't the time to discuss policy matters like gun control. When an apparently Muslim Uzbek national used a hired truck to kill at least 8 people in New York, there was no such hesitation at all. And to some, it said everything about Mr. Trump's willingness to exploit fear of Muslim immigrants while doing nothing to offend his gun-loving core supporters. Within 90 minutes of the New York attack, Mr. Trump had tweeted, "Not in the USA," following up half an hour later with an apparent immigration reference. "We must not allow to ISIS to return or enter our country." All before he got round to offering his condolences to the victims and their families. Within hours of the New York attack, Mr. Trump was explicitly linking the incident to immigration policy action, informing his Twitter followers, "I have just ordered Homeland Security to step up our already extreme vetting program." Yet, after Stephen Paddock used a semi-automatic rifle to kill 59 and wound more than 500 in Las Vegas, it took over 24 hours and the prompting of reporters before the president so much as mentioned gun control policy. And even then, he only said firearm laws would be discussed as time goes by. Those were his words. He didn't specify when. And amid the clamor to condemn lobby groups like the National Rifle Association, he seemed to stick closely to the line articulated by White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee that this isn't the time to go after individuals or organizations. This time, though, Mr. Trump showed no qualms at all about going after individuals or organizations. Many were furious that Mr. Trump appeared happy to rush to make political gains by stirring up hatred against Muslims and immigrants while deflecting questions about gun control to avoid upsetting his core supporters. What do you think of that, eh? What do you think of that? So, I like that. And you know what? Donald Trump is therefore a hypocrite. Double standards. And someone just sent me a picture of an American wearing a t-shirt. The words on the t-shirt read the following: saying all Muslims are terrorists is like saying all Americans are like Donald Trump. I like that. Saying all Muslims are terrorists is like saying all Americans are like Donald Trump. So, what was the name of this chap who drove his truck into the people in New York, killing 8 and injuring dozens? His name is Saifullah Saipov. Saifullah, that's his name. Saifullah. Saifullah. This O is a fool. What did he hope to achieve by killing these people? Was it a blow for Islam, the killing of innocent people? And will that make it better for Muslims in the United States? The fact is that such actions add further fuel to Islamophobia. More attacks on masajids, more attacks on hijab-wearing women, and so on. Such actions are counterproductive. They have the opposite effect. They don't help Muslims, but make their lives harder. This O is a fool. He wanted to put an ISIS flag in his hospital room. Of course, as you know, he was shot in the stomach. And then he also said that he felt good about what he had done. You know, I feel like giving him a few tight claps and a few hot kicks up his backside. That will make me feel good. Or should I just go outside and scream at the sky? You know, another politician made me scream yesterday. Here is what the British Independent newspaper reported. Dear listeners, you can also scream. That's right, you can also scream. The interview is on YouTube. The interview is on YouTube. Here, let me just read to you what it said, what the British Independent newspaper said yesterday. It says, Israel's deputy foreign minister has denied Palestinians are living under Israeli occupation, instead of referring to the West Bank using the term Judea and Samaria. Speaking on the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, which signaled British support for the creation of a Jewish homeland, Zippy Hotovely said Israel gives equal rights to both Arabs and Israelis. Her remarks were challenged on BBC Radio 4's Today program by host Nick Robinson, who said Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank do not have equal rights, and that much of the international community recognizes the West Bank as being under occupation. And then she replied, I deny the idea of occupation. She says those are places where in the last 25 years the Israeli government was trying to give the Palestinians all chances to have their own ruling. And then she says, Palestinians refused every time to have their own self-determination. When Mr. Robinson pointed out that the UN and many governments recognize the West Bank as occupied by Israel, Mrs. Hotovely said, Israel could not be an occupier in a land that the Jewish people belonged for thousands of years. Poof. So as I said, you can also scream. The interview is on YouTube. Just type in the words, Israel's deputy foreign minister, and the word no occupation, and you will hear this mampara spew out this nonsense. And so to the Balfour Declaration. I'm sure by now you all heard about it. It's all over the place in our media, on our radio stations and so on. But there was a big rally in Pretoria, outside the Israeli embassy, organized by the EFF. And, as usual, it was straight talk from Malema. But you know what? I fell off my chair when he said that there must be just one democratic state for all the people, Jews, Christians and Muslims. Wow! That was the first time that I heard a South African politician say that. Hey? And you know what? I also believe that. One state for all, like South Africa, no Bantustan-like structure. A two-state solution, first of all, won't happen. Israel won't allow it. And even if it did, it won't be truly and completely independent. And even if it was truly and completely independent, that is the West Bank, the Gaza, and East Jerusalem, where Al-Aqsa is located, yet it won't be addressing the core problem, the fundamental problem, the refugee problem, the fact that people were chased out of their homes in what is now Israel. So, a two-state solution will not solve anything. The injustice will remain. It will be maintained. And to the and the only just solution is one democratic state for all. And Malema said it loudly, very loudly. And so I applaud him. Well, on social media, there are some detractors who say that he is an opportunist. He's just looking for votes. You may have your own views about it, but I think that's a very silly thing to say, especially about his speech. You know, most politicians don't want to speak strongly against Israel because it may attract powerful attention that would be detrimental to their careers, as happens in the United States. And as you've probably heard, it is alleged that some political parties here attract great support, financial and otherwise, from supporting Israel unconditionally. So, all I want to say is full marks to Malema, whether you regard him as an opportunist or whatever. And maybe the word opportunist can apply to the fact that he seized the opportunity to make a very, very strong statement, very loudly. But one thing you cannot deny, as I said, he said it loudly and clearly, that Palestinians are victims of Israeli oppression, and it got huge coverage in our media, especially the SABC, and thereby the message reached thousands and thousands of people. So what's wrong with that? I would venture to say that it has greater impact than some of our pro-Palestinian marches, which are of course well intended, but often don't get great coverage. And so, dear listeners, I applaud Julius Malema. Lots to speak about Balfour, but let's leave that for next week. It's time to round up. And as we usually do on The Big Picture, it is time for Light at the End of the Tunnel. And here's a recycled one. Bobby from Overport wasn't feeling too well, so he went to the doctor. Now the doctor took his pressure, checked his sugar, and checked everything, in fact. Gave him a full checkup. Then he shone a torch into Ronnie's ear. There was something there. So the doctor put in a tweezer and pulled out a 100 rand note. Then he pulled out another 100 rand note. Then another and another. Finally, all of the notes were taken out. And the doctor counted them all and said, "Wow, Ronnie, I can't believe it. You had 1,950 rands in your ear." And Bobby replied, "Yeah, doc, I know I wasn't feeling too grand." Okay, here's the last one, short one. Do you know how to make money with WhatsApp? Yeah, do you know how to make money with WhatsApp? Well, I'll tell you. Here is what you should do. On WhatsApp, go to settings. Then go to group settings. Then click on delete group, and then go out and go and work. Okay, right. This is A.P. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.